This week in Retronauts, we're hopping mad for Namco. Everyone, I am Jeremy Parrish here with Retronauts in the Retronauts studio, which apparently is a thing now, according to Benj Edwards, who's sitting there across the room from me. Wow, guys, introduce yourselves. Who's here?
Benj Edwards.
Oh, yeah, I just mentioned it's you.
Also known as Deadly Tower Number 2. That's where you live.
You're the Twin Tower?
It's the window, man. Oh. The Deadly Tower. I'm looking at him right now.
Right.
Sorry. And Ben Elgin, sliding into the Namco version over here after doing Sega earlier.
Are you sliding into the Minchies?
Yeah, I think so.
Isn't that who Mappy fights?
Might be. But yeah, I missed the early Namco, so I'm kind of coming in midstream here, and we'll see how it goes.
Right, I couldn't remember who had been on the previous episodes, and it would be so much work for me to like jump on the internet and Google it for like 10 seconds. So welcome to the Namco discussion. I'm sorry that you missed the really cool formative stuff, but
well, there's some stuff in here. Yeah.
Yeah. This is where Namco gets wild and crazy. Yeah. And no one does wild and crazy like our fourth chair.
Hi, it's Chris Sims. Do you mind if I run to the bullet room real quick?
Bullet room. is that what we're calling the bathroom now?
Yeah. Cause I have to jump over a railing to get there.
All right. Yes, we're going to be talking about Namco. We have done two of these episodes already. We've talked about the early, early days of Namco. I think it's two, right? Two previous episodes.
It seemed like it was 5 years ago.
Yeah, I know, so man. Well, I put these notes together back in like October.
Yeah.
And then we've done other like things came up like, you know, yeah.
Well, we had to double out the end of the year. So.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it didn't help that the years in review episode ran way over.
We talked too much.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, today's notes, this episode and the other one we're recording, were prepared back like 6 months ago. So if we seem a little rusty on these topics, it's because we deeply researched these half a year ago and now we've forgotten everything. So take a trip back in time with us, 6 months, to explore the world of Namco from 1986 to 1988. Where were you guys in 1986 to 1988?
I was 10, so elementary school, yeah.
In 1986, I was 4, so I did not know what video games were yet, because that would only happen later.
Your parents sheltered you?
Yeah, well, I got a Nintendo after I turned 5.
By age 4 these days, kids are like Fortnite pros. They've made $100,000 streaming on Twitch already.
Yeah, they've already gotten in trouble for saying bad things on Twitch.
Oh, yeah, they've already like revealed themselves as racist.
Four-year-old has already had to issue a public apology.
Exactly. It's a different world. Okay.
But yeah, so I was picking up my Nintendo somewhere around here. Like Super Mario 2 was like 88, right?
Yeah.
Something like that.
In America.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was about this era. Yeah.
Yeah. In 86, I was 5. 88, I was 7. That's wildly different. Every year of your life is, you know, like 10-year block when you're that age.
Right. So. As opposed to now where you just like live by 10-year blocks.
Yeah, every 5 seconds is a 10-year block.
I don't know what you guys are talking about. I live my life a quarter mile at a time.
Yeah, I meant the opposite of that. Anyway, so 86, I probably saw NES for the first time at a friend's house. We played Atari 800 games a lot at that time and 2600 games still before we got NES, I think in 88 probably. So that's about where I was.
Yeah, for me, 86 was where, you know, I got my NES and... I think a little bit before that, we got a ColecoVision, Coleco Atom, after those things were cleared out for $10 because no one wanted them.
I still don't want it, and I've got a couple of them.
But the tape drive, yeah, the daisy wheel printer.
Yeah, the tape drive, I mean, if you turn that thing on with the tape in it, it could wipe out the tape or mess it up.
So. Yep, yeah,
so probably not a lot of us were hanging out in arcades a whole lot yet.
No,
at this
like
point.
Arcades were very vibrant in the first half of the 80s, and then you got to the second half of the 80s, and... they became noticeably less so.
Yeah, but a few of these things you could find hanging out in like restaurants and stuff. So I know I've seen some of them, you know, Pizza Hut, Chuck E. Cheese.
Yeah, I feel for me, the my encounters with arcade games around this period of time was mostly at pizza places or at like Putt-Putts.
Yeah.
Because, you know, friends, like a couple of times a year, I'd have friends who had birthday parties at Putt-Putt. So their arcade area never got smaller, even after the golden age of arcades kind of imploded. They just kept putting new games in. So stuff like this, you know, this is around the time that Atari Games split away from Atari Corp and started making really, really influential, groundbreaking arcades. Like the American arcade scene really kind of came back to life around this time with stuff like Rampart and Gauntlet and, I don't know, APB, whatever the hell, Rampage, you know, Midway, Williams. They were doing really cool stuff.
Was good.
720, Granny and the Gators, maybe not Granny and the Gators. That was one of the hybrid pinball video game.
Oh yeah,
along with cool. Pac-Man Junior, yeah, whatever the hell
Pac-Man
it was.
Pac-Man Junior.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway,
that was Baby Pac-Man, right?
Anyway, so yeah. So most of my arcade memories from around this time are of those American games. So I feel like almost all of these games are games that I discovered years later, mostly thanks to stuff like the Namco Museum collections for PlayStation. It was just this huge and creatively vital period of time in video game arcade game design that just kind of slid right on by. So I'm glad we can take the time to revisit.
But yeah, and as we were saying before we started, but Namco does like go back and mine these properties, even though a lot of them were almost just one-offs, but you'll still see this stuff pop up in like, you know, theme song remixes and little cameos. And, you know, some of this stuff was in Smash. And
yeah, I feel like they really got into their own history during the PlayStation era, because not only did they do the Namco Museum collections, they also they started just making references to their old games. Mm-hmm. Like in Ridge Racer, you'd have the Pac-Man labels on cars and graphics and decals, which culminated in Ridge Racer Type 4 with a car that was actually shaped like Pac-Man and drove around with a do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Mm-hmm. It was kind of amazing. I've never unlocked that one myself, but I've seen videos of it. And to me, that just further cements the fact that R4 is the greatest racing game of all time. But you also had stuff like Klonoa, who had a little Pac-Man on his hat. And you had, you know, this is when the PlayStation era is when Mr. Driller came around and they were like, let's do something with Dig Dug and turn it into this entirely complex soap opera storyline and so on and so forth. So yeah, I really feel like Namco did itself a great service by acknowledging the fact that it had, you know, it had a glory day that was different than its current day. Like the company still makes great games that sell really, really well. But it recognizes like this was a previous phase of our life and people still love these games and they were important and formative and we should continue to celebrate those. And very few companies do that. Nintendo does it, and that's Sonic or Sega maybe to a certain degree, but Namco is pretty unique in that regard, and I think it helps, you know, sponsor or inspire episodes like this, podcasts like this.
Yeah, no, very few companies have that kind of legacy, the Nintendo, Sega, and Namco.
I mean, there's a ton of Japanese companies that do in the art, like Taito, but they don't really do that. I guess that's because Square Enix bought them, and they're like, we need our pretty boys killing monsters.
What's the best Taito game, though? Bobble.
Space Invaders.
But I mean, that's so old. It's not even, you know.
But it was huge.
Yeah, it was huge.
It was formative.
But Namco had like one after another after another after another really cool games for a while.
All right, smart guy. We'll do a Taito series and we'll see where you stand. There's also, you know, like the Darius games. They did Rasten Saga. They made a lot of games that were pretty big hits.
It would be nice if Konami acknowledged that they made video games.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah, that'd be great.
At some point in the distant past.
I think the last time they did that was with the collection of games for DS, which was kind of cool, even though like the DS didn't have the right resolution for it.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, it was like Konami Classics or something like that for DS. It was developed by M2. This is totally off topic, but like you could bring up arcade dip switches on the bottom screen, and you could use the DS stylus to like change the dip switches and settings on the arcade games. It was just it was one of those like. Even though the DS wasn't the best platform for that collection, they really just filled it full of love. And I want them to come back, Konami, do that again. You have so many great games that have been lost, and some of them show up on arcade archives occasionally.
Put Symphony of the Night on Switch, you cowards.
Yeah.
Just to kind of wrap this this discussion of Namco's love for its legacy, before the podcast started, we were talking about Shifty Look because Chris was, instead of socializing, he was watching the Wonder Momo anime. So what's all of that about? You have opinions about Shifty Look.
I do, because I actually knew a bunch of the people who were involved in Shifty Look. Corey Cassone, who was one of the editors, I think maybe the like main actual editor at Shifty Look, although don't quote me on that. I had worked with him a
little... Too late, it's on Wikipedia.
I had worked with him a little bit at Oni when the first graphic novel that Chad Bowers and I wrote together, Downset Fight, was coming out. It was released by Oni. And it was really impressive that they did Shifty Look and got the creators that they got. The Galaga comic is incredible, if you've never read it.
I need to read that.
Well, it's Ryan North, who people might know from Dinosaur Comics, the Adventure Time comics.
He has an amazing ability to pull a lot of content out of almost nothing whatsoever.
Yes, it's drawn by Christopher Hastings, who you might know from The Adventures of Dr. McNinja, and also is the writer of Gwenpool for Marvel and various other things. And the colorist on it was Anthony Clark, who you know from Nedroid and from multiple collaborations with those guys. And it's a really, really fun comic. And
does it get into the like whole space century thing that Namco did with like the very complex narrative around Galaga?
No. It's focused on these two girls who figure out that when the Galaga spaceships are blown up, they make they blow up into pixels, and you can construct your own spaceship from them, and then they go fight all the Galaga invaders.
So it's like the gummy ship?
Yes, I guess. I don't know.
Nice.
If you don't know what a gummy ship is, you're in a better place than I am.
Yeah.
I don't know. So I'm doing great. Okay.
Well done.
What is Shifty Look?
Yeah, I was going to say,
The name of Namco, Bandai Namco's
Initiative,
I guess. It was shiftylook.com, and they did a bunch
McFury came out and said, I want to talk to you about the Shifty Look Initiative.
It was 2012, and they did a bunch of comics online that were just based on properties. And they did a ton of them, and none of them are up anymore.
Shifty there was Look. Mappy, who was like a disgraced retired cop.
Yes.
And there was Wonder a Katamari Momo. One.
There was Katamari.
Wow.
There was a Klonoa one that I know Jim Zub wrote. There was Rolling Thunder.
Wasn't there a
Thunder.
Sky Kid?
I think so.
Yeah.
There was Rolling Thunder, which was written by Jimmy Palmiotti, and I got mad because I really wanted to pitch Rolling Thunder, and I never got the chance to. And I think I could have done something really good.
What year did this happen?
2012 to 2014.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they were all designed to be finite webcomics. Like, Galaga, for instance, has a beginning, middle, and end. And then 2014 comes, and they're like, okay, we're done. And part of what they had attempted to do, according to like the official press release, was just raise awareness of these brands and maybe give them an opportunity to relaunch them in new forms, which is what happened to Wonder Momo, which got a bizarre 5-episode OVA, I guess, if you can call it an OVA when it's released to YouTube. An OYA?
I mean, it's original video animation.
Original meta animation is a thing sometimes.
It's video and it's animated, so it's original.
Yeah, it's like 5-6 minute episodes. And then there was a WayForward Wonder Momo game that was tied into that. Was
that like a web game?
It was mobile.
Okay.
So no one has played it that I know.
It does seem like a good and fit in a way for WayForward because they kind of brush up against that kind of skeeviness that's in Wonder Momo sometimes.
Yeah,
it's a good style fit for them.
And 2014, it ends. And then by 2015, it's gone. It is like shiftylook.com doesn't have any of it anymore. So
like surely someone archived it all somewhere. But
I mean, maybe.
Definitely not. And don't call me Shirley.
Yeah.
Namco didn't.
No, I know.
Like there were plans to do printed versions of some of the stuff. Cause I know Udon, which is the company that you might know from doing like the Mega Man art book, Phoenix Wright art book, the Street Fighter comics. They did, I think, 2 paperbacks. They did a Bravo Man.
The Katamari was printed, wasn't it?
I have no idea.
I thought the Katamari one was printed once. I mean, it may have been a brief run. I don't know.
But there are all these like kind of, you know, 100 page Namco comics that they just completely took off the web, and I have no idea why. I don't know, like, you'd think those would be available in some form, but it's been probably, 5 years, and
it cost more money to make them available than they would generate. So that's why they haven't printed them. You know, that's the story of everything.
Why they haven't printed them, but they already had them online.
Yeah, but
and they own the rights to it all, so you wouldn't think it would be a problem.
I mean, look, I know nothing about the contracts of those guys working. Again, I never got to pitch. I would have written a great one.
Terrible, tomorrow,
by the way. No, they were good. Okay. Well, some of them were good. I didn't read all of them, but I know that Galaga was actually really fantastic.
I read the Katamari one. It was cute. I mean, it was kind of insubstantial, but you know, it's like the cousins interacting and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, what are you going to do with Katamari?
Yeah, I mean, you have all the cousins and you have them like, do stuff.
Get into the horrible backstory of the king? No, don't do
that. But again, you know, the people that they had working, like Jim Zub wrote the Klonoa one. He's doing Avengers now at Marvel. Ryan North's a 2 or 3-time Eisner winner for Adventure Time and Squirrel Girl. They could very easily get an audience for these but I have no idea what the contracts were, if there are like rights issues. I'm sure they will work for hire.
Well, you're raising awareness right now. Maybe someone listening.
Put them back up or put them on Gumroad or something. I would pay a Gumroad download fee to read that Galaga comic again.
Alas. So why don't we go ahead and actually jump into talking about the games? I can already tell we're not going to make it through this list of games this episode. But why don't we start
towards the end too?
Why don't we start in 1986 with a game that definitely did not get a shifty look comic, Genpei Tomaden, or the Genji and Heike clans, which I guess that name was kind of retrofitted into it with the PlayStation Museums, wasn't it? The game never came out in the US in the arcades, and then they stuck it on that compilation and we're like, this is what we're calling it. I don't know. Everything about this game is weird. I don't understand what this game is about, why it exists. I'm glad someone created it, but what were they? How high were they?
It really does not look any fun to play at all, unfortunately. But it also looks like kind of three games shoehorned into one.
Right.
It's very weird.
Yeah, it's like a horror game and an action game and hack and slash.
It's got like three different viewpoints. So there's like this side scrolling stuff where you have these big sprites that almost look like flash animated kind of deals. It's weird. It's not something you see back in this era. But they're like, you know, they're big and detailed, but move really jankily. And then you've got like these top down sections with these tiny little like super undetailed sprites. And I have to wonder, did like three completely different teams of people work on this game? I don't even know.
I mean, in the context of the time, this was, you know, right around the time that Japan collectively was awakening to the appeal of role-playing games. This was the same year that Zelda came out and Dragon Quest, that's right. So everyone was starting to be like, well, we've got more space for our video games, more memory space, so we can do more stuff. What should we do? We should make it role-playing. Like, so they started doing that multi-format, multi-focus thing. And how do you take an RPG and make it into an arcade game? They'd already done that with Tower of Druaga, and that was a big hit. So I guess they were thinking, maybe we should do something along those lines with this game too. And I don't know that it was a success, but it's definitely one of those just like bizarre fever dreams that you get from some Japanese games of this era. Like Zombie Nation by Meldak for NES. Do you guys remember that one where you're like a giant samurai head flying through modern cities,
yes,
blowing stuff
up?
Oh,
that
one. I didn't know that's what it was called.
Yes, that's one of the most expensive NES games now.
Huh. You fight the Statue of Liberty, right?
I've never played it because it's one of the most expensive NES games now. Yeah. But I remember seeing screenshots of it in Nintendo Power being like, what the hell? And this game gives me that same sense. Like it's set in medieval Japan and you play as, I guess, a samurai warrior or something.
Well, except it's actually set in like hell, most of it, isn't it?
Right. But I mean, I feel like, you know, it's set in hell during the...
It's medieval Japanese hell. Right. Yes.
Exactly.
Definitely. Jigoku. Yes.
I feel like we talked about this on the last episode of Namco 2.
Did we?
And Hopping Mappy, because we made a bunch of jokes about Hopping
Mappy.
We made a bunch of jokes
about Hopping Mappy, but we didn't actually talk about this.
I don't know. Yeah. It's been so long, I can't.
Well, so my
we mentioned if we talked about Genpei Tomaden, I did not don't remember any of it. I know we mentioned it, but
I don't know.
Do you know what that means, Genpei Tomaden?
I don't. Den means legend.
Yeah.
Okay.
There you go. It's the legend of something.
But, yeah. Like
not
my
Zelda,
one
though. Definitely not Zelda.
My one exposure to this, like I had never actually played the game, but uh, the the music made it into, I feel like it was an early Smash or something for some reason. I don't know why, but like, but the title theme for this game is like literally 10 seconds long. And so I had this like package I had downloaded of like all the tracks from this Smash that someone had padded out to like 3 minutes just by looping them. And so this one would come up and it would be these 10 seconds over and over. I'm like, oh God, skip, skip, skip. Huh. So that's my memory of this game, is skipping the theme music because it's really short.
Yeah. This is one of those games that just plays up. It's the fact that it is set in, you know, like Japanese folklore, Japanese tradition, mythology, whatever, by just covering every bit of the screen with, very Japanese looking things, from, you know, kappa demons to bamboo trees to a score counter that increments in traditional like Japanese kanji as opposed to Arabic numerals, which I don't know if you guys ever read Legends of Localization by Clyde Mandolin. He's a No. friend of Fan Gamer, but he recently wrote a piece about how when people translate Western games into Japan, they make the mistake of thinking everything needs to be turned into Japanese, but you know, English and Arabic numerals and so forth have always been part of video games, because back in the earliest days of games, that was, you know, there wasn't space for kanji or or pictograms or anything like that. So that's just become part of video games. So when you see a game that deliberately makes the stylistic choice to use kanji for its score counter or whatever, it stands out. Like it has to be a deliberate thing. If you do it casually, you're like, oh, here's my sci-fi game set in, you know, 24th century space, and you go too far with the localization, players in Japan are like, what the hell? But if you know, have something set in ancient Japan or feudal Japan, and then you use the stylistic choice, and that's what they do here. The K.O. Yuga Katai games, I don't know if you guys have ever played K.O. Flying Squadron. They do that too. You don't see it very often.
Well, you see it for like medieval European stuff too. Like a lot of the early Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy stuff. Like I remember when I was in Japan with a host family, I had the sheet music for them, and they were helping me translate the tracks. And a bunch of it had like archaic forms in there, just because it was supposed to be a medieval, you know, castles and that sort of thing. Yeah.
Huh. That's a neat bit of information I did not know until I listened to Retronauts.
I'm happy to share other people's writings and learnings with you.
The thing that I wrote down about this game was that this is what people in the 90s who didn't play video games thought video games were. Because it's like, look, Mario doesn't make any sense. We all agree on that. But it has its own internal logic.
Yeah.
This game does not. This game is just things on the screen.
We talked about the internal logic thesis before among ourselves in other episodes. Mm-hmm. Like, what makes a nonsense game make sense, you know, and what's just total mess. But
like, there's a scene in Rumble in the Bronx where Jackie Chan hands the kid what is very clearly an empty Game Gear, and the kid starts playing it immediately after getting it in his hands. And anytime something like that happens, or you see people on TV like playing a video game and nothing's connected, this is the game I imagine they're playing, because it is capital letters video games to me.
Yeah, it really does feel like the kind of thing that someone would just bash together for, you know, graphics for an imaginary video game in a 90s movie, for sure. Like Gleaming the GameCube, that's it.
Yeah. I've never played this. I cannot imagine it is fun to play. It doesn't seem like it would.
It looks super janky.
Yeah. But I do highly recommend, if you want to experience this game, there is a two-part episode of Game Center CX that is quite good.
Series doesn't give you a lot of two-parters, so you know this game is something special.
Yeah. Unless you're Donkey Kong Country, in which case you get three parts. See if you can get through that one.
All right, so next up is Hopping Mappy. And I know we did talk about this a little bit, but let's just put it down. This game is also really weird. I think we did talk about this last time.
Yeah, the note that I made on this one was incomprehensible.
Yeah, like, why is Mappy always hopping? It seems like pure hell.
And it just looks like a mini game that someone decided was its own entire arcade game.
I can't. The only thing I remember about talking about this was that we decided that maybe Hopping Mappy was a play on Hopping Mad.
Maybe.
That's why they chose that word hopping, and then they just built a whole video game around it or something. I don't know. That's what I remember from episode two, you know, 10 years ago.
It does the same, like, background day-night cycle that happens in Pac-Man 2, which makes it look like Mappy is hopping endlessly for hours.
Pac-Land?
Yeah, Pac-Land, that's it.
For hours and hours, yeah. Yeah, so this is like Animal Crossing, essentially. It's got
sort of.
No.
It's like if all you could do in Animal Crossing was play those mini games on the island forever and ever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess, you know, after Mappy was a disgrace to the police force, this is the hell he was relegated to. He is also in Jikoku.
Apparently.
Anyway, I don't want to belabor the point, but Hopping Mappy is a really weird game, and I feel like it kind of speaks to this the sort of weird divide that Namco had in the late 80s, that they were making these really sort of advanced looking games like Genpei Tomoden. But at the same, and then you also had games like Rolling Thunder. Like, these were very sophisticated looking games, very advanced. But then you had stuff like Hopping Mappy, which feels very sort of primitive early 80s arcade. You had Toy Pop, which is even more, it's like super dated. I can't believe this game came out in 1986. It's like, my notes say Pac-Man meets Pengo. And yeah, you're like these really simple little top-down block graphics, and you're walking around kicking and shooting stuff.
Yeah, that was the note I had too, that it seemed like there was just kind of this expectation that no matter what else was going on with your cutting-edge arcade stuff, you would have at least a few games that are just these top-down maze puzzles, because, I mean, you know, because Pac-Man's a classic, because there are the, and you're just expected to have that in your catalog, kind of, that you have these just 2D, simple-looking puzzle games.
I can't remember what I said about Hopping Mappy. Everything I knew about it, I forgot already.
This is a swimmingly
it's great
preceding episode. All right, so I will say that when you have games like Hopping Mappy and Toy Pop, you might think, wow, Namco really lost the plot. But then you have Thunder Scepter and Thunder Scepter 2, which are like this is the kind of game where you look at it and you understand, oh, this is why Namco is their greatest rival is Sega, because they were both kind of sniffing the same cocaine and creating the same kind of like crazy out there technological experiences. Thunder Scepter, I wish I had known about a little sooner, because about a year ago, I did a Super NES Works episode on HAL's Hyperzone for Super NES, which is a game that, you know, it's like a first person, or not a first person, but it's a third person behind the ship shooter. It's kind of like F-Zero, except, you know, with the ability to move up and down in addition to side to side. And it uses that Mode 7 effect for the racetrack in F-Zero, but it mirrors it. So it's like you're always flying down these like tunnels, I don't know, like these kind of narrow passageways, and you're sandwiched between rocks and water and I don't even know what else. And it was very technically impressive and kind of fun, but not that great. But I wish I had known about Thunder Scepter, because this is that game 5 years earlier and actually more fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically just a tunnel shooter. You've got this constrained space that you're also always moving forward, but it's got an interesting graphical style going on with, like you said, you've got both a ceiling and a floor, but then it's open to the sides, and they've got these like cool, like, sort of pulp retro SF backgrounds going on there. So I don't know, like, as a game, it didn't look like it had a ton going on. There's not even like really bosses. There's just bigger enemies at the end of the level. But it's got a really cool looking style, you know, it'll grab you from across the room kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, this is very, oh,
are there any home ports of this game? Cause I've never seen them. Or
probably heard of them. For some Japanese computer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised if it's on the X68000.
Yeah.
It seems like the kind of game that they would put on the X68000.
This is the kind of game I would love to play if I had a home port. But I feel like the consoles at the time weren't sophisticated.
Oh, no. There's no way a console could have done this. No. I mean, like I said, this was something that you saw imitated on the Super NES 5 years later.
Yeah.
Took a while. And even then, that was kind of like eye-popping, like, wow, I can't believe my home console is doing that. That's crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah, it very much is kind of a Space Harrier, sort of afterburner-ish kind of thing. It's not as impressive as those games. It doesn't have that sort of, I don't know, there's something about those games. They're so fast-paced and they're so visceral, almost to the point where they're not even playable. Like, you just feel like you're barely hanging on. Yeah. In fact, there is even a game called Hang On that uses the same tech. How about that?
Yeah, when I said this, I felt like I didn't feel quite as drawn to it as I did to all the Sega Superscalar games. They just seemed like you know, they were faster and had more going on. But this does do interesting things with its own style that you couldn't do with the ones that are strictly Superscalar that are using just the sprites for everything, because it has the more complex backgrounds and the Mode 7 stuff going on.
It's technically not Mode 7, sir.
Well, no.
But I know what you mean. Yeah,
that's the shorthand for the effect.
Yeah, it's fun. I think that's a conversation in and of itself. Like how this very specific technological feature of one kind of hardware has become just like shorthand for a visual style.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting. I guess that's the credit to Nintendo Power and their propaganda.
Yeah, probably.
Buckle up and face the sparks.
What is this a reference to?
That's what it says between missions.
Oh, does it?
Or two?
Oh. I've only looked at Thunder Scepter 1. Because they're kind of the same game. This is kind of like Galaxy Force. Actually, it's a lot like Galaxy Force. Like, Galaxy Force's kind of toned down uncle, I guess.
Something like that.
I mean, Galaxy Force came along a couple of years later. So it's way more impressive, way faster. There's a lot more moving around and scaling and stuff. But the overall vibe is kind of the same. And Galaxy Force 2 is basically just Galaxy Force, but better. I think Thunder Scepter 2 is pretty much the same thing.
This is making quarters. Let's just make more of it.
So another sequel on from 1986 for Namco, and this one I think is more focused and sensible than Hopping Mappy. Like, I don't understand why Hopping Mappy is, but the Return of Ishtar is the sequel to Tower of Draga, and I think it's pretty clever and makes Tower of Draga more playable and less punishing. And also adds a co-op element that I think is really cool. So when I say it's a sequel to Tower of Draga, I mean literally, like, Tower of Draga is about Gilgamesh the warrior climbing to the 60th floor of the tower and rescuing the princess Kai. So the Return of Ishtar, you have rescued Kai, and now Kai and Gilgamesh have to go back down those 60 floors and fight their way down. Of course, these floors are now different, but you're playing together with two characters, and it's kind of like a big maze, but there's more scrolling. You don't have to see everything on the screen all at once. It's not as dense. So there's more freedom to run around and explore and make your way down. I think it's a really cool game.
Is there any other game that does that, like picking up the moment the previous game ends? Like
Half-Life 2 Episode 1.
Okay.
You actually start from the ruins of the Citadel base or whatever that you infiltrated at the end of Half-Life 2.
Interesting. I mean, at a stretch, there's the Richter segments at the beginning of Symphony.
Fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel a few games have done this.
That's just a prologue. But...
Yeah.
But which you know, and Wonder Boy 3 did that first. The beginning in the final stage of the previous game, fighting against the boss and then advancing from there.
Okay. Yeah.
I just think that's a really cool idea, and I'm kind of surprised you don't see it more often.
Yeah, I feel like if we sat down, we could name some games that do that. Half-Life is definitely the one that the episodes, because you start out with just like the zero force gravity gun or whatever it's called, and zero point, and you're like super powered, but you like gradually lose all your stuff as you fight, and then you have to kind of rebuild yourself over the course of, you know, this very short sort of one-third length game.
Metroid 2 doesn't do that. Metroid 2 does the end.
All the Metroid games are self-contained in spaces.
Okay.
So, yeah, you don't really get that.
Okay. Just think it's neat.
It is. It's a cool idea. I think it's a great concept, and I don't know if anyone had done that before. Surely someone had, but... Oh, yeah, the Zork games do that, but that's because they started out as one game. that had to be split up for space reasons.
Well, those aren't video games. Those, as Bench will quickly point out. Yeah.
It all depends on how you want to define it.
Well, I mean, Zork Zero has graphics, so...
Zork Zero is a video game.
Well.
I'm just kidding. Yeah, I don't care anymore.
That's the attitude that I want from our Retronauts.
Well, we should not do these sessions before lunch anymore, because I'm really hungry.
Are you hangry already?
Coffee,
it's not even
buddy.
Noon.
Yeah. Coffee.
So...
All right, so do you guys have any thoughts on the Return of Ishtar?
I don't know. Like, watching it, it seemed like with this, like, it seemed really zoomed in on these big mazy levels now, and it seemed like it'd be hard to navigate, like, until you've played it enough to know what's where. But I don't know. I was just watching a playthrough, so I haven't tried it in person.
Well, I think it's great that they don't just make Kai, you know, like, a helpless damsel tagging along with you. She becomes integral to the experience and like a co-partner with Gilgamesh.
Yeah.
So, you know.
I love co-op
games. Yeah, that's cool.
It's such a great thing to throw that in there.
1986 was kind of the year of lady empowerment in Japanese games. You had Samus Aran, you had Wing of Medulla, you had a few other games where ladies
Athena?
Took the lead.
Around there, maybe?
No. Yes, Zelda? I guess Athena, yeah.
I don't know if Wonder Momo counts either, but... A little borderline.
Now, the opposite of female empowerment in video games comes with our next title, which is Rolling Thunder, which is a great game, but definitely falls, you know, relies on the kidnapped lady losing her clothes progressively between stages as incentive for you to make it to the end and beat the bad guys. But you're fighting Piccolo, which is interesting.
Huh. Piccolo.
Yeah, the bad guy... pretty much looks like Piccolo from Dragon Ball. Yeah. He's like the screen guy.
But the rest of the game entirely looks like Lupin, and it looks so cool.
Well, Lupin fighting neon clansmen. Everyone, all the bad guys are like KKK.
Yeah, it's actually...
Hood guys.
Yeah, like they look like Miyazaki goons, actually. Which makes sense, because Miyazaki directed a bunch of Lupin.
Yeah, when is Castle of Cagliostro?
That's a good question, because
it's the mid-80s, right?
Castle of Cagliostro was like 1979, 1980.
Yeah, that had been around.
It was
that had been around
movie.
Already.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah, these definitely seem to be drawing from like some stock Miyazaki designs.
Well, I mean, they've also got the kind of hooded look of Cobra Commander. And I think that overall look was based on a French character. There's a G.I. Joe comic where Cobra Commander, like someone goes to a costume party and the Joes are like, oh my God, it's Cobra Commander, but it's actually someone dressed as like Il Fantôme or something like that, like a French character. And
that's interesting.
Yeah, he's like basically wearing a Cobra Commander outfit with the hood and everything, but he's costumed to someone else.
Yeah, a lot of it's the more like kind of European influenced side of manga designs with this tall, lanky characters, again, like Lupin.
Yeah.
That was striking to me when I played this game. This is one of those few games on this list that I played in the arcade, because it was, you know, I've mentioned Gatlinburg, Tennessee many times, that we'd go there on vacation and they had lots of arcades. And this is one that really caught my eye because it was big and beautiful. The sprites were big and the guy was, you know, more realistically proportioned than some of the
SWAT
little
characters.
He has a name,
Binge. He's Albatross.
Albatross, yeah.
And like the animation of it is just gorgeous. Like,
yeah, this game rules. It has its problems, but it also rules. I love
the problems are pretty
game.
Modest, honestly.
Just the way that Albatross moves is really good, and there's obviously a lot of emphasis on how he moves. He does like a Spider-Man pose when he jumps, which is really cool.
Yeah.
And I love that animation of him like one hand on the rail hopping over to jump up and down on the two levels. I also love that when you press the shoot button, he gets out his gun, shoots, and then puts his gun away.
That's the samurai tradition. You never just run around with your sword. You draw it and then sheathe it.
Yeah.
But yeah, he also has kind of a 60s spy guy sort of thing going on. Like
Lupin
very
by
man
way
from
of Golgo.
Uncle. Yeah.
I
well, I was going to say like Man from Uncle, like Ilya or whatever his name was, you know, with the kind of the turtleneck and everything, not wearing a suit jacket like James Bond, but rather kind of a more streamlined look that, you know, would actually be feasible to run around in. He's got the shoulder holster and everything. Yeah.
So it occurs to me we should maybe say like what kind of game this is and how it actually plays. So
it's a really cool game.
It's really cool. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, side-scrolling waves of enemies kind of thing going through levels.
I mean, this is another Namco versus Sega thing. This game is Shinobi.
Yeah. Yeah.
Basically. Except you don't have a melee attack. So you have to watch out for bad guys, because if they come up close to you and you don't shoot them in time, they'll take off half your life.
Yeah, but you have the same, take off your full. The same like multiple level kind of thing going on. So you'll often have like a lower route and an upper route, and sometimes a foreground route and a background route where you can go behind things. And yeah, like Chris was saying, that just the way you like vault between levels, just over railings and stuff, it just looks so cool.
Yeah.
Also, when you like gut shot dudes and they like fall over holding their
crumple in different ways.
The sprite work is really impressive. Mm-hmm. Also, if you never played this game but you grew up with an NES, Codename Viper is this game, but not as good.
Codename Viper is very good. Codename Viper is very good.
Okay.
Codename Viper is more beatable than Rolling Thunder.
That's true.
Rolling Thunder turns into a giant asshole in about stage four. And at that point you realize, oh, Namco doesn't like me very much.
It wants my quarters. That's
what then if you get through that, it loops eventually and gets really mean.
Right.
Yeah. So like one of the things this game does is you get to the end and like, but the end isn't really there. You have to do the whole thing again in remix mode.
Thank you, Albatross, but our Leela is in a different enemy fortress.
Hey, that's a great development technique. And if you don't have enough budget to finish the game, you just make one of the stages incredibly hard that no one can pass it.
Well,
they never notice.
That's actually not a good development technique.
But it's also doing the thing where you're reusing and remixing the same assets.
It's horrible. I just don't want anyone to take the wrong ideas away from this podcast binge.
Anyone really listen to what I just said and think I was being serious?
I think so.
You're very difficult to tell.
Absolutely. People listen to this show for development tips all the time.
Man. Sorry, guys.
You have so much more influence than you realize.
I've been giving out bad advice as jokes for years.
So here's the secret. You do the same level again, but twice as many enemies and also lava pits this time.
Yeah. I guess I just mean that it doesn't look as cool as Rolling Thunder, Codename Viper.
Viper, yeah.
Yeah. Although Viper is a much cooler codename than Albatross. Albatross, bad codename.
I mean, that's the big ship at the end of Bionic Commando.
Yeah. So
what is that telling you? One thing we mentioned or forgot to mention is that you can duck into doorways, which is what
the bullet rooms
Chris was referring to at the beginning.
Love the bullet rooms.
There's rooms in the game, like doors, and you can duck into them. But the ones that have the bullet logos on them or say bullet will either give you a rifle for your handgun or I think the ones that say arms will give you a submachine gun.
Machine gun refill, yeah.
That's like 50 bullets to it.
I just love that the bullet rooms are clearly labeled. And I love the design of the bullet room sign, which I wish, why can't I go on Fangamer and buy that right now?
And, you know, I feel like this game borrows a lot from Elevator Action, which was a Taito game, by the way.
Yeah.
And that also had the doors that you could duck into for, you know, helpful purposes.
Well, and even if there's not bullets there, it's a strategic element because you can avoid attacks that way and jump out and kill somebody.
Right. Yeah. I feel like the doors had a little more tactical purpose in Elevator Action, honestly, because when the doors opened, it would block an enemy bullet. And so you could kind of duck away. And also you had to go into doors to complete the stages, the red doors. Here, basically, if you go into a door to hide from enemies, they're just going to hang out outside the door, like walking back and forth. So there's no way for you to get out without taking a hit. So you can kind of screw yourself over. It does make going into the bullet rooms or the arms rooms, kind of a risk reward thing where it's like, well, I could upgrade my machine guns, but then some KKK guy in a neon yellow mask might walk around outside and, bump me off as soon as I get out. So what's the play here? I do like how all the enemies are color coded by uniform, and each different color of enemy has different skills and tactics. It was very thoughtful of, Gal. What's the guy's name? I forgot the villain's name. Ugga?
Gal Ugga.
Gal Ugga. No.
No.
I want to say Garlaz, but that's the name of the area travel through in Rygar. I messed up.
The bad guy. Yeah. Anyways.
I was never good at this game, but like I would play it every time I went to the arcade because it's very satisfying to play. Like it feels good to play this game.
I have a point to make about this, about the hoods and things that I was just thinking about, which is that it depersonalizes the enemies to the extent that you feel okay just mowing down hundreds of them.
Yeah, we talked about that in the Raiders of the Lost Ark podcast. Nazis are okay to kill.
Yeah, and this is something like that where they feel more like the Foot Clan kind of, I know they were robots in the cartoon or whatever, but it's something where you don't see their face. You don't see them suffer that much. I know they double over or whatever, but
generic it's cultists
dehumanizes them. So yeah.
Are they even human? I mean,
I don't know.
Who knows?
Galdra, that's his name. He's like this green alien dude. Like I said, he looks like Piccolo. I don't know who these are. Yeah, so yeah, these guys may not even be human.
Cool.
Just like the Fekagoons.
Yeah.
Well, then you get things like lava dogs and stuff later, so there's definitely monsters running around here.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and the giant bat dudes swoop down and are pretty much impossible to shoot.
And the Zartans.
But Zartan is a named character.
Yeah, but there's dudes who, like, turn invisible, and then they come out of the walls, and they're all weird.
So alien cultists.
He killed the Hardmaster.
Or did he?
To let you know, we can really shake them down. Starting with Wonder Momo, we've moved on to the year 1987, and a powerful peach has begun the... I don't even... What? Help me here, guys. Momo means peach. I don't know.
It does. So it's this
help
like...
Help me out.
It's a superhero peach. Momo. Like Wonder
but not
Woman.
To be mistaken for Momotaro, who was also a superhero peach.
I don't know. I'm sure.
Okay,
Peach.
So
hero Peach.
Yeah, but a superhero of folk herodom. Okay.
Okay, so Wonder Momo. It's it's this strange little beat 'em up, basically, where you're literally on a stage playing this schoolgirl who can do this henshin transformation into a superhero, but you're just walking back and forth. So it's like the stage area is like, I don't know, 3 screens wide, maybe. And costume goons come at you, and then there's these sort of tokusatsu like monster bosses, but it's very much framed as being this kind of low rent stage play thing, which is a thing that happened. You would have these like tokusatsu live action productions that would go on in Japan, at amusement parks or at a theater or something.
Yeah, it's like TMNT on ice, but
it's kind of that kind.
Not as big a production.
They still do them at malls to like promote the new shows. You'll go see like a little live action.
They'll do little live action tokusatsus. Yeah,
thing with the new Power Rangers or whatever.
And so
the new Super Sentai team, I suppose.
Yeah, and so it's just sort of recreating that like budget stage play. It kind of looks like everyone's just in costume and as props and stuff.
Wow, that's fascinating premise.
Yeah, and it just keeps doing this.
I noticed the audience down at the bottom of the screen and some of those things. They're sort of cheering her on as she goes.
I mean, that's basically what Beautiful Joe is.
Yeah,
pretty much.
Yeah, it's kind of doing that same kind of thing.
It's definitely one of those games that, like, as you learn more about kind of Japanese pop culture, then you start to realize, oh, that's what this is about. Because the first time I played this, 20 years ago, I was like, what? What is
what,
this?
What are you even doing? Yeah, it's sort of hard to tell what the point is.
30 years ago, I would have been like, what? What?
So they actually released this in America with a dedicated machine, Wonder Momo, in an arcade.
I'm actually not sure. It was definitely on a Namco Museum collection.
Yeah, it's been ported to a bunch of home systems, and it's come out.
I forgot 20 years ago. It's like,
sorry, you're old and we're dying.
Yeah, that was okay. Yeah, just like 20 years ago is like a couple of years ago.
But and this is a property that Namco has gone back and mined a lot. It was in Shifty Look. It got the anime that Chris was talking about, and it's just like the theme song for this has shown up in a whole bunch of places too. Even though I don't think there's been any other.
There's never been like a proper sequel.
Yeah.
Like, Namco's never done anything with the game itself, but Momo herself is a very, she has a lot of personality. Like the game does have a little bit of skeeviness to it where she tends to flash her underwear more than is probably proper for someone her age. But at the same time, like the game opens up with a parody of the MGM, you know, the lion thing, but she like pops up and she yawns. It's very cute. Like she's a very charmingly drawn and appealing character. And
she's got that Rumiko Takahashi.
Yeah.
Yes. Like that, the fluffy hair 80s manga character thing.
There's this whole sort of subgenre like of anime and manga from back in that era, which is like, has this like slightly skeevy edge to it, but it's also cute and good natured. You can't really hold it against it. And it's all very tame compared to later stuff. So.
Right. Like there's definitely no waifu collecting in Wonder Momo. Yeah. It's not like a modern mobile game. It's very circumspect about its horniness.
I have a hot take.
Okay.
Oh dear.
This might be controversial. I feel like Wonder Momo either needs to be way less horny and more cute and like fun, which is kind of what I think they're going for in Wonder Momo, or needs to like go way to the other end of the scale.
We don't want Wonder Momo to go Valis X.
And be like Bayonetta, where it's horny to the point of being kind of hilarious. Like if they're gonna do a parody, then they should go all out with it.
Yeah, but you know, Bayonetta is probably twice Wonder Momo's age, so...
No, I don't think she should be a teenager if they do that. I do want to... Sorry, I did leave that out. That is a necessary clarification.
Thank you, Chris.
Then she needs to... Either she needs to be a teenager and be cute and funny, or they need to... Also, Bayonetta's immortal.
I honestly just think, like, put some bike shorts on her and we're good to go.
Yeah, well, and you're also thinking about this from our current context. Like, there was not the context to do Bayonetta back in the 80s. I don't know.
But there's also, like, the dudes in the crowd who are trying to take upskirt photos of her, which is, like, the worst part of the game, that is worse. I feel like.
Really? Also the most realistic. There's a lot of that going on.
It's skeevy enough to be uncomfortable, and the cuteness doesn't balance it out. There's an imbalance, is what I'm saying. So either... Yeah, go with one or the other.
I like Jeremy's solution. Put some biker shorts on her and it'll all be fine.
but you know, that aside, like it is a fun and interesting take on the sort of belt scroller, you know, like Kung Fu. This is basically the same thing as Kung Fu Master or Bad Dudes versus Dragon Ninja or, you know, Vigilante, et cetera, et cetera.
In the actual gameplay, you're mostly like kicking and punching these goons until you manage to power up.
And then when you power up, you have an energy ring that you throw, but you have to catch it when it returns.
It's kind of a magic hula hoop kind of deal.
But you have to catch it when it returns because it can fly off the stage if you miss it. And then you are reduced to doing Ultraman things where you do the cross beam with your forearms.
It's got all the little tokusatsu tropes, but yeah, I feel like the magic hula hoop is kind of Wonder Momo's thing. That's like her signature gimmick. And then like if you play this long enough, you get like weirder and weirder bosses, and then eventually you get like a rival magical girl.
Never made it that far. I've made it like a few stages in
the game. I haven't played that much of it, but I watched back months ago, I watched YouTube of this for quite a while, kind of skipping through until different things eventually started to happen, because it does get very repetitive.
Right.
But then every once in a while they'll throw something new at you, like this rival magical girl that comes in.
Yeah, it's weird to think about this as being a tokusatsu parody. That's obviously like riffing on Kamen Rider, riffing on Ultraman, but it's, what is this, 87? So it's 5 years before Sailor Moon. So it doesn't have any of the real Maho Shoujo stuff, which existed at the time, but wasn't, you know, Sailor Moon kind of codifies a lot of it.
It comes before a lot of our current context for magical girls.
Yeah.
It's a very kind of prototype of that sort of thing.
Yeah. The anime, the 2014 little anime I was talking about, I don't think is worth watching, really. It seems very,
alas,
here is a property.
Well, I like that each of the stages is represented as like a volume and chapter of a manga. So like the game ends at world or volume 4-4. And when the screen, when you get your game over screen, she's like wearing a towel on a curtain that goes up.
Either less or more.
I'm with you there. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Less, I think, would work.
I think less would be better.
Do you know what the like little names of the episodes are? Because I can tell, I can't read Japanese at all, but I can tell that they have the format of like a tokusatsu title where it's like something, something, exclamation point, something, look. Something.
If are they kanji or not? Because kanji are going to lose me, but...
I couldn't tell you.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's all in, like, super dense kanji. Dense.
Nope. We're not going to be any help for you there.
It's probably, fight, like the alien invader attacks.
Yeah, it's probably, I'm sure it's that kind of drawn-out episode title thing, but...
No, I mean, it does have that structure where it's, like, it says something, exclamation point, and then there's a sort of something that is spoken
aliens attack,
less excitedly.
Wonder Mobo's very hard day. Right. Yeah, that sort of thing. I'm sure that's what it is.
I feel like we, right now, in about 10 minutes, can plot out a better Wonder Mobo game than Wonder Mobo.
Where are you on all this, Binge?
I think it's interesting that you're criticizing the, I don't know, the sexiness of this game or something. Just, I like to look at things as period pieces that are not judging them from a current historical point, like our current standards and mores. And
no, at the time I would have been like, oh, that seems kind of weird.
Yeah. So, yeah. So that's a fair point. Yeah. Even back then, if this was really
like, if my parents had seen me playing it, they would have said, no, don't do that.
Yeah. So that's something worth mentioning.
I just don't think it's enough of either direction to be funny.
Yeah.
Or it's clearly being a parody. Like, and I like the parodical elements. Like you talked about the MGM opening. That's like a really cute, funny bit, but like, the game's not good, and it's so you know, aesthetics aren't enough to make the game better, to elevate it, I think.
Was it imitating a style that was popular in animation at the time or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean,
like
it's the, I mean the whole thing like, is very much of the time. You know, the like broad like sex comedy was kind of a thing there, so where it was just a little bit skeevy.
Yeah, I mean, this was concurrent with Ranma 1/2, pretty much.
Yeah, so. That sort of thing. And, you know, it doesn't look great from today with the upskirt shots
and
that kind of thing.
She even does a split kick, two-direction split kick, which is really funny and weird and obvious. like, she goes like this and kicks.
Right, well, she like just holds her skirt down when she does that. So
yeah, but
there
it's
is
still
some
like, it's still such a...
I don't want to get hung up on talking about a young girl flashing her panties. That's not what we're
doing. Yeah, but this is its that's its like a defining characteristic. You know, this is the upskirt panty game, essentially. Wonder Mama. There you go.
Okay, well,
you don't have to like it. That's just the way it is. We didn't make this game.
You don't have to like it.
Yeah,
that's just the way it is.
That's I said it. Yes.
Okay,
it is of its time.
That be the last we say about Wonder Mobo. Next up on Namco's release list is Yokai Dochuki, which recently got a fan translation of Shadowlands, and that's what we're going to call it. This to me looks like it is supposed to be based on an anime, but I guess it's not. But it looks like Gegege no Kitaro or something.
It's definitely got
it's got that very like it's very much that sort of like creepy kid in a Japanese yokai horror kind of universe sort of thing.
Yeah, there was kind of a very codified set of like yokai designs and aesthetic that a lot of things draw from, and it seems like this is just generically that.
Yeah, it's one of those weird games that, you know, when I first encountered it however many years ago, I was like, well, this is weird and exotic and strange. And I think nowadays kids would be like, oh, hey, look, it's the hopping umbrella with one eye. I know that guy from Yokai Watch.
Yeah, from Yokai Watch, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, things like this have become, I feel, much less exotic to Western audiences because this sort of imagery, even though it is so culturally specific, has, you know, trickled out more into media in other countries.
Mm-hmm. But it's got some weird ideas. Like you said in there, it has this like kind of Adventure Island feel because you're just, you know, always going to the right, collecting things. But there's a little bit more exploration that there's, you know, some split paths, and then there's these shops and
he can stomp on frogs like Mario squishes a Goomba. I just saw that in a video.
Don't do that to frogs. My gosh. Well, they're probably demon frogs, so I guess that's okay.
I think a really notable thing about this game is the layout,
because it's got a weird interface.
The active part of the screen is only the bottom half of the screen. The top half is like stats and a weird little mini map that doesn't... It's more like the Castlevania mid, like between inner level map than anything else.
It looks very much like that. And like,
do you think the hardware couldn't handle it more than half screen or something?
I don't.
Like
I think this
it
was
looks
their
really good. I think.
Yeah, I think Namco's hardware was totally capable of pulling off a full screen game. But I think this was an attempt to kind of do the Adventure Island thing. This also kind of catches on to the same concepts and stuff that you saw with Capcom games at the time, like Black Tiger, where you are on an adventure, but, you know, even though it's kind of like a simple arcade brawler action game, there's shops and stuff. There's currency and economy.
Yeah, and there's parts where you jump up and get into a shop and you're at the top of the screen, and so the stat stuff just slides over.
Yeah, it scrolls the whole interface. Then, I thought that was really cool.
This is a Nintendo DS game.
It kind of feels like a DS game.
You could easily remake it that way.
Have any of you played this? Because it looks fun.
No,
I've only watched it. It's got a lot more shooting than Adventure Island does, but
it looks neat.
It's got like a charge shot, so it's kind of this weird in between slice, like an in between a runner or an explorer, but it's also got shooting and charge shots, and I don't know. It's got a lot of stuff kind of shoved into it.
You'd have to really hate frogs to play this game.
This is a game that really—it's one of those games that looks like it could be on the eShop today.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I could see that.
I think it's also
a good thing.
No,
that's fine.
Okay, because.
There are lots of cute little sort of retro platformer action games that show up on eShop.
Yeah, I mean, you could dump this right onto Switch, too, yeah.
Yeah. But I think it's also worth mentioning that this game feels like a spiritual successor to Dragon Buster. Dragon Buster, the Namco sort of proto Zelda 2 kind of game where you were running through and you had like a branching map and doing that same sort of thing. It didn't really have so much of the economy and stuff, but this feels like the next step of that, but instead of going for a Western fantasy milieu, it goes for, more Jigoku.
We spent a lot of time in Japanese hell in this episode.
Yeah, like
this,
I mean,
what was going on at Namco in the mid-80s?
That seemed to be a big dark time for this period.
Wait, someone, there's some notes on here, and no one's reading these off. PC got blessed by a large naked lady in a pond for some reason.
Yeah, I was watching the playthrough, and that was one. So there's several things like.
Are we talking like the Zelda fairies?
It seemed to be something kind of like that. I wasn't sure quite what was going on, but so you know, there's these places where you can split off into a different path and hit the top of the screen, and usually it's a shop. But this one was, and it was actually on the mini map too. That may be an actual use for the mini map that seems useless most of the time, but it showed this lake on the map, and so the guy split off and kind of went back to the left for a little bit and got to this lake, and there was a large naked lady bathing in the lake, and she like sprinkled some stardust on him. I'm not even sure what good it did, but.
What was going on at Namco?
I don't know.
It's a strange misappropriation of the Arthurian legend.
Yeah.
All right. So also in 1987, another sequel, and this one's weird. I've never been able to get into this one, even though I love the franchise. That is Pac-Mania. The first attempt, I guess, to take Pac-Man into 3D.
I guess
Super Pac-Man kind of attempted to do the 3D with Pac-Man flying over the maze, but this is more like... it's not isometric, but what's that called?
I think it's close to it.
Do you know the word for it? Come on,
when it's just tilted instead of being.
That's kind of isometric.
Yeah, but it's not.
No, there is a different. You're right. There's a different word
when it's sort of higher up, flat.
When it's skewed instead of actually being rotated. I can't remember the
anyway,
word.
Anyway, it's isometric-ish. There's a technical name for it, and someone's going to post an angry comment.
Like back
the
when
messages.
Back when I took drafting class in high school, I could have told you, but that was a long time ago.
We should do an episode where we get as many things wrong as possible in one thing.
That's all of our episodes.
But anyway, this is, I think, actually one of the first things on this list that I actually played. I'm pretty sure I ran into in like a pizza restaurant somewhere.
I love this game. We've talked about it before, I swear.
Yeah, somewhere.
Was there a Pac-Man episode?
I remember seeing this actually for the first time in like, it must've been like 1991 or 92. It was much after, like a long time after the game came out, but I was like, wow.
Yeah. I think these last
Pac-Man's one still around and two, he's like in 3D now.
Yeah. So this is like, everything has this 3D rendered aesthetic.
I hate this.
Yeah. Everything has this 3D rendered aesthetic. Like Pac-Man and the ghosts are very round and like highlight
shiny. Yeah.
And you can jump. Yeah. Which is weird, but it's this weird, floaty jump. I could never really get the hang of it.
Yeah. It's hard. You got to time it.
It's hard to tell when you're going
to
come down. You can try to jump over the ghosts. Only some of the ghosts can jump too. And then it just starts throwing more ghosts at you. I saw it get up to like 8 or 10 ghosts at a time.
Yeah, and this is much harder than classic Pac-Man because you can't see the whole maze at once. So it's really hard to keep a beat on the ghosts. And this is something that I've addressed in talking about stuff like Game Boy Pac-Man and that sort of thing, because when you take away that information, the ability to see everything around you, it gets really hard. I mean, this I think this is a big part of why Pac-Man was more successful than Rally X. back in 1980 mm-hmm. because Pac-Man, you could see where everything was moving, how things were moving. Rally X, you had to like look over to the radar, which was a really cool innovation at the time, but it just wasn't as like immediately intuitive as being able to just follow your character around and kind of see the enemies out of your peripheral vision and know where everything was.
Yeah. And so like this being zoomed in and having the more ghosts, it trades off and you get much more frantic and less strategic action, mm-hmm. I think, which, and you know, it was an interesting direction, but I think it makes it not as enduring as the original setup.
I feel like this is the game that should have been called Pac-Man 2. Because
it's iterating
on the design.
But it's more like Pac-Man 3D.
Oh, I like the board with the Lego block kind of.
Yeah, there's the
coolest,
cool
aesthetics
going on. This
game blew me away when I first saw it. I must have seen it pretty close to its release. And either at an arcade. I know I played it later at the Gatlinburg arcades and stuff. I felt like this was one of the games I could play and sort of be good at, even though I wasn't good at some other games. And I was young. I mean, I was six and when this came out. So games were hard. And I love the fact that you could jump over the ghosts, which you couldn't do in the regular Pac-Man. It felt like a way out when you were cornered or something, you know, or stuck somewhere. I don't know if there are any dead ends. I can't remember if there are in this game. But, you know, you could be trapped between two ghosts coming at you from two different directions and jump over one of them. And the aesthetic, the visual aesthetic looked so sleek and futuristic at that time. It was incredible.
Yeah, this was before you really saw pre-rendered graphics. Mm-hmm. But this, even though this wasn't pre-rendered, it had that sort of glossy, like light-sourced 3D look to it.
I mean, are you sure it wasn't it? It could have been a rendered sphere.
They did some very limited rendering at the time.
Yeah. But I don't think so.
I mean, yeah, it was really early in your ability to do that. Like, but Pac-Man is basically a sphere. So
the whole like pre-rendering graphics thing was really like a big innovation that Rare pushed with Donkey Kong Country.
Right, but that was when you could really do like actual... You had the computer horsepower to start doing actual characters as opposed to just geometric shapes. I mean, you could render geometric shapes a long time ago.
They took... The logical extension of Pac-Man was a disc in the first game. It's a circle. And say, okay, we're going to take this into 3D. He's a sphere.
Yeah.
And what do spheres look like? They're rounded on the top and they're shiny. And then, okay, the ghosts are flat. What do they look like when they're in 3D? They're like spun it around.
And all they had to do was take the old Pac-Man board game. Did you ever have that?
Yeah, but
ghosts were like little, little cylinders with jaggy bottoms.
The Pac-Man was
a puck.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Pac-Man was a puck in that one.
He wasn't a sphere. Yeah.
Well, because he didn't want to roll off the board. He had to be able to like, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, is this the game that codified that instead of having like Western cartoon eyes, Pac-Man has dead black eyes like a doll's eyes?
Dead eyes.
I don't. I feel like
I think he has black.
There were a lot of renditions of Pac-Man back in the day. Everything from, you know, the Namco style with the big nose and the little Pac-Man eyes.
And there was like the waddly thing. Like,
well, and then there was like the Atari 400 version, I think, where he was like a guy with a suit and a fedora. He just happened to have a big yellow head. Like, that was the one that was also...
That
was also the one that was canonized in Bloom County.
Are you talking about the artwork for him?
Yeah, the cover art.
There's Atari 800.
Oh, no, he's the marathon.
Running. Yeah.
I love that.
But yeah, the fedora, weird, I'm getting all... There is one where he's wearing a fedora, but he's like a lanky humanoid.
There's also the weird like waddly yellow blob monster that was in the art for one of the games. I feel like it was on an arcade cabinet or something.
He's like a teardrop shaped. Yeah, teardrop shaped with little feet facing in different directions. And red eyes.
Yeah, I don't know where that came from.
The fedora is from Pac-Man's YouTube videos about how Ms. Pac-Man is killing the games industry.
Okay.
That wasn't out back then, Chris.
No. But, I mean, this is what happens when your character is just a circle. It gets interpreted a lot of ways until you have later games that nail it down.
I'm just going to say, if we're wrapping up on Pac-Mania, I think this game is completely underrated. It's better than people
I mean, it was definitely well-produced. It, like, it's kind of depends whether the gameplay clicks with you.
Okay. It's self-consistent. It feels solid. It has a good premise and concept, and it executes it well, I think, even if it's difficult. So that's why I feel like it's a good, solid kind of game. I have this weird thing about games. Like, it has to feel good for me to want to play it. I can't even describe it. It's something that where everything comes together. The elements are cohesive. The graphics are good, and they make sense. The sounds are good. You know, this game... I know the music. I can't even recall what the music is, but the music is cool.
It has some fun remixes of the original Pac-Man tunes.
I think it's a solid game that's underrated in terms of like it was competently produced and made, and everyone forgets it and they don't really play it. So that's what I'm saying.
I definitely felt like it was well made. It's just it's kind of a question of whether the jumpy Pac-Man gameplay clicks for you or not. For some people, it did.
I mean, my biggest frustration with it is just how limited the field of view is. When I play Pac-Man, I want that sort of it's almost like it's not instinctive, but it's just like this kind
vision,
of
you can see
it's everything. Like a holistic view of everything. I want to see how the things are moving around, even though I'm not very good at predicting patterns. At least, you know, being able to see, are all the ghosts over there in the corner or where am I going?
Mm-hmm. I think that, this is why he had to be able to jump to get out of.
But then you got the jumping ghosts, those little bastards.
Yeah, that's when the game gets really hard.
It's just it's more twitchy and more reactive and a little less strategic than the original formulation. But
you know, I remember I saw this game at the same time that I saw the Empire Strikes Back game, or no, Return of the Jedi game, which was not what I expected. I was expecting another like Star Wars arcade game, you know, vector art shooter, but instead Return of the Jedi is like an isometric sort of shooter with speeder bikes and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so both of these games are kind of lumped together in my mind. I will say of the two, this holds up better.
We're done with Pac-Man.
So next in 1987, and I guess that's wrapping up 1987, is Dragon Spirit, which is a another game that I never saw in arcades, but did see on NES. But I think it was a two-person shooter in the arcades? I want to say it was.
I feel like it was a co-op shooter. This game is really beautiful and made me want to play it. I think I played this in the arcade.
So tell us, what is this game, Benj?
It is a top-down shooter, but instead of a spaceship, you are a dragon. And I think you can shoot fireballs out of your mouth.
Mm-hmm. Or mouths.
Mouths.
After you power up.
Yeah, you can get two mouths if you want. It's a two-mouth kind of game. And it has a layering element with backgrounds, according to my show notes, and it's very metal.
The whole game is very metal. I think Jerry
wrote it. I wrote that. If it's in black,
but it is. But
that.
I agree. Like you're fighting these. It's got this aesthetic to it that's just like, what are some cool medieval weird things we can throw in? So you're fighting like fire breathing dinosaurs, and then later you have like dinosaur ghosts.
Yeah,
and,
I mean, like, this is like this might be the first shoot 'em up that its origins can be traced to the side of a van.
Yeah.
It's weird that you don't see this more often. Like every top down shooter is an airplane or a spaceship.
Yeah.
I don't know how many dragons, two headed dragons fighting dinosaur ghosts I've ever seen.
You occasionally get
there. There've been a few, but not as many.
The side of the van thing is an interesting comment that I think other people won't understand.
What? You know, everyone knows van art. They know
airbrush, it's a 70s fantasy, kind of thing. Yeah.
Well, you'll know if you're next to Jeremy in traffic. Right. He's got that airbrushed Hayankyo alien.
Yeah, exactly. It's what keeps my white van from being quite so creepy.
So the other game. Who made Legendary Wings?
That was Capcom.
Capcom, yeah. That's the other shooter where I always remember it's not a spaceship. And that was cool. And that was co-op, I think.
It was,
yes. Based on the NES. So maybe Dragon Spirit wasn't co-op. I don't remember.
I'm not sure either, but...
But man, it looks neat and sort of fantasy elements.
Yeah, so. And it has some interesting gimmicks for a shooter. Like it's got like kind of these multi-layered backgrounds, and sometimes they move. So there's some stages where like there's cavern walls that kind of close in on you, and you have to avoid them, and that kind of thing going on. There's also like dark areas where you have to evidently like collect power ups to replenish your light source, and that just looks kind of annoying. I'm not sure.
I've never played the game that far.
Well, yeah. Again, I was just watching a playthrough. That happen, but.
Someone wrote "Jazzing Up with Joy." What is that?
I think that was in the ending text after you beat the game. Something about jazzing up with joy, because everyone was the whole kingdom was joyful that you had beaten the evil dinosaurs.
But it's metal, not jazz. Someone skipped the memo.
It's about the power chords you don't play.
But it also, yeah, so I did watch all the way through this game on YouTube, because it also had this thing that ties back into what we were talking about with Namco really enjoying its history, that there is actually a literal history of Namco arcade games in the credits of this game.
Oh, yeah?
Like, you beat this game, and it scrolls through, like, old Namco games, saying, remember this cool old stuff we did? And this was only 1987, even. So.
My goodness.
By the way, you a third head, so it's a three-mouth game.
Oh, there we go.
You don't get a third head, though. The flames just become bigger coming out of your two heads.
I see three heads. Are there three heads? Some of these pictures, yeah.
All right.
The ones that are flashing up in my brain. Definitely not looking this.
The reliable narrator.
No, those are two heads. I don't want anybody to go into this game being like, I love games where you have three heads. I don't want anybody to be disappointed. That's all.
I think that's fair. All right. So another shooter that's a little more standard fare. Although, also very familiar. I guess that would make it standard fare. Mm-hmm. What am I saying? Oh, right, it's Galaga 88. So I guess that means we're on to 1988. My goodness.
It mixes it up, too.
It does.
So it's not just normal Galaga.
And this one is this one's great because it's one you can play on Switch with Flip Grip, which, to toot my own horn, but that's a great way to play it. And it is like a fancier version of Galaga. They spent some time trying to figure out, how do we build on the Galaga thing? And you got some games like Gapless and so forth, and you're kind of like, I don't know about this, but Galaga 88, it's just it has the basic premise of, if I'm not mistaken, I forgot, it's been a while, but
I mean, you're still fighting the alien bugs. You can still get your ship captured and get it back to have multiple ships.
Yes, and you can have triple ships now.
Yeah, although it sort of melds into one big ship when you get through. Right. But you get the triple shot going on, which looks really useful.
No, I started talking and then I just, like, my brain froze it up. I couldn't remember. Is this the one where you can capture enemies? But I think that's Gapless.
Whereas
this is a little more standard.
You can triple up your own ship.
Right.
But, like, the thing that this... So the mechanics of your ship are still pretty much the same. But the thing that this mixes up is kind of the levels. You start out going through these standard Galaga levels where they come in waves and form up at the top. But then, like, you do a bunch of those, and eventually you start to hit these longer scrolling levels where it's basically a scrolling shoot 'em up suddenly, only with Galaga enemies. And it's kind of
right
fun.
And they kind of do like a combination of the flight formations and the ranks at the top of the screen. It's a really interesting sort of midway point between that.
Yeah, you'll run into sort of like bits of Galaga levels while scrolling through this longer level. And then it does fun things like have like a bunch of teeny tiny ships come into a formation that looks like a pixelated version of a big Galaga ship. And like, they threw a lot of cool things in. I kind of like it.
Yeah. And the art style is, you know, I said that Dragon Spirit was very metal, and this is very not metal. It's like everything is a balloon animal. Everything is all rounded and colorful.
This is like,
and
there's Pac-Mania.
Yeah, it's exactly. It's got all this like shading to it. Mm-hmm. So it gives you like this kind of cute take on Galaga, although it's still very challenging. It looks adorable and then it blows you up.
Well, and then there's the bonus stages with the That's Galactic Dancin' stages, which is right. Like, every once in a while, I'll throw one of these in, and it literally says, That's Galactic Dancin'. And then it comes in with some weird background music. Like, the first one is like carousel music, but then there's one that's like a waltz and one that's a march. And it just throws in these formations that are clearly like doing these choreography routines where, meanwhile, you try to blow them all up for bonus points. But although it's kind of got this bad incentive in that, like, if you blow everything up too quickly, you don't get to see some of the like choreography. But
so blow things up slowly.
Yeah, but then some of them get away and you get less points.
This had a wasn't this on TurboGrafx or PC Engine only? Because
it came out as Galaga 90.
Okay, I wanted that
because it took a couple of years for them to compile it.
Yeah, I wanted this. Gosh, their computers were so slow. By the way, you can play Galaga 90 on the with the BX88 joystick that I made.
There you go.
So it's not just a Flip Grip thing. It's really great.
Flip Grip will let you play it vertically.
Yeah.
And
mine will let you play it normal, horizontal. I don't know.
And I'll write you a story about it.
Yeah. What do you do, Ben? Etch things with a milling machine.
Yeah, with a milling machine. Sure. I can etch some. We can do that.
Perfect. All right. So we've really got just a full suite of options available here for Galaga 88, but it is a great little game.
Yeah, the other thing that reminded me of some of the like kind of beefed up. So it had some of these beefed up kind of like pulsing fleet formations in it, which here's where I was doing in 88. It reminded me of Solarian, which is the old Mac riff on Galaga. And I looked it up, and these were basically contemporary. So they were basically just going in some of the same directions at the same time.
Yeah, I feel like this, the classic shooter, classic arcade shooter done cutely was a thing that happened sometimes. You also had Taito create Return of the Invaders and Attack of the Lunar Loonies, where they basically took the Space Invaders characters and made them,
goofy Space Invaders.
One of those, I think it was, I want to say Attack of the Lunar Loonies was Taito based on Space Invaders and was super cute. But I know there is a super cute Space Invaders.
Yeah, it's like kind of the primal origins of the cute-em-up.
Right, and then you had stuff like Parodius, which was Gradius, but adorable.
Yeah.
And then Twinbee just started out super cute.
And we had another one of those later in the list, too.
Yeah. There's like Magical Chase and other stuff. You know, just these adorable shooters that are also, by the way, hard as hell and will destroy you.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let your guard down. It's all a lie.
It'll ruin your life.
So, actually, it looks like the next game on the list, I didn't put a date on it, but looking at the YouTube
never
video...
It came out. Just kidding.
That's right. Actually, it looks like this was from 1987, so we skipped ahead a little bit. But this is called Blazer, and it's very strange. It reminds me of...
that tank game? Contra.
Yeah, the tank game, and I can't remember what it's called.
Isn't it? I don't know. There are a lot of tank games.
There are. I realize now they all kind of blend together.
There's a Konami one, isn't there? Or was that the...
It's like a free-roaming tank warfare game presented in the style, the not isometric, but the other style, oblique projection. Oblique projection,
that's it. That is the word you were looking for.
I don't have to go back and edit that in.
Although I thought this one was
please
more
stop sending the emails.
But you go like this game has the oblique projection.
Right. I record it later with that a cold totally oblique projection. It has the same sort of presentation as Zaxxon, including the sort of dimensionality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But like that as a tank just feels really weird.
Yeah. Well, like, you know, Namco also kind of did the shooter world as a tank thing with Grobda, which was one of the tanks from Zevius. But instead, the game, I think we talked about that in a previous episode.
Yeah.
You were like one of the tanks from Zevius, like going around shooting stuff. So it kind of puts things on the other foot. Like, you know, here's the little target guys you blow up that are on the ground. Now you have to be them.
Yeah.
How do you like that?
Yeah. And this
how
is
do you like them
it's
apples?
Also kind of the opposite way of, so you have your scrolling shooters like Zevius and stuff where you're shooting things in front of you, but also bombing targets on the ground. And this flips it around. So you're this tank on the ground and you're shooting things in front of you on the ground, but then there's also things flying overhead and you have to like lob shots up to hit them, which seems really awkward to keep track of. Although it gives you like shadows under the flying enemies so you can kind of track them. And it seems like it's actually pretty forgiving on the hit detection, which I think it has to be because otherwise it would just be impossible to keep track of trying to shoot the things overhead while you're driving around in this tank.
Right. And according to my notes, which I compiled a while back, but I'm willing to believe myself, this game was only released in Japan and has never been compiled on any collection.
I had certainly never seen it before.
So it's MAME or nothing for you, pal, if you want to play Blazer.
Yeah, this is a deep cut.
It is.
As far as Namco games goes.
You do sometimes become a helicopter.
You do. Yeah.
Oh, right.
You flip it around.
It kind of does the Spy Hunter thing, actually.
Yeah.
It's just like life. You become a helicopter.
It is just like life.
I mean, if life is like Yoshi's Island, then absolutely yes.
Yeah, I'm a helicopter.
Yeah. Isn't that what Forrest Gump said?
Life is like becoming a helicopter.
Yeah, like Yoshi's Island. You always become a helicopter. We need to eat lunch, man.
I guess so.
Moving on to the next surreal game.
Yeah. Speaking of deep cuts, the next game is called Quester, and it is Arkanoid. And I had never heard of this before I started putting together this list.
I was skipping over that one because it just looked like Arkanoid.
It is literally just Arkanoid. Yeah. I want them to have like an event based around this game and call it Quester's Fest.
But I want to talk about the next one because it actually looks cool. Yeah.
Come on, that was good. All right, it was
it wasn't bad.
It was awful. Okay, yeah, let's talk about March and Maze. March and Maze is a cool game. This is a 1988 game, and it's also isometric or oblique projection, whatever the hell.
I think this one's actually isometric.
I don't care. But, I don't know.
This one, yeah, this is one I had never seen before, but looks cool, and I kind of want to play it now.
Yeah, it's kind of a combination of the last two games we talked about. Galaga 80 with the cuteness, mm-hmm. and Blazer with the isometric combat.
But you're like this little girl, Alice, and like shooting marbles at things. And like this, the aesthetic of this reminds me of Marble Madness. Because you've got these like isometric, like floating tracks, like over this distant background. And the fact that there's lots of marbles rolling around, because basically everything shoots marbles, so that kind of helps the comparison.
Yeah, you know, there was was it Libble Rabble, one of the previous Namco games we talked about that also had
that episode,
you weren't there that episode. Do you guys remember?
Just been too describe long? It and I'll remember it. Yeah.
It's kind of like this, but not isometric.
Libble Rabble.
Libble Rabble.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
I want to say that's the one it was.
I don't remember.
I don't know.
This game is weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It would
yeah.
all come back to me. But March and Maze, this game looks incredible.
Yeah,
I've never like seen it before in my entire life.
It's a gorgeous isometric, I guess, 2.5D platformer.
Yeah.
Kind of with a shooter element to it.
So there's a lot of enemies and you're trying to roll your marbles over them, but it also looks like it really ramps up the kind of platforming challenges pretty quick, because you end up with like moving platforms and like rotating bars you gotta jump over, and it sort of expands from being a very linear track to being a more you can go different directions and collect power ups for your marbles kind of thing. Just, it looks like a lot of fun. It looks like it's got a lot of cool ideas.
So
and
you're
then,
a girl in pigtails.
Yeah,
you're
so the
Alice.
Aesthetic is, you're
You're
Alice.
Chasing after a rabbit.
Okay.
Yeah, there's this white rabbit that gives you advice sometimes.
So that's why it looks like a drug trip. Mm-hmm.
It's yeah,
just,
yeah,
like
it's true to the original text.
When I skimmed through
the second level has the Salvador Dali melting clocks background,
right?
Which is pretty weird.
Well, so when I skip through a long play of this, and it actually gets it kind of doubles down into the Alice, but even weirder in that like. The Red Queen is some kind of robo alien. By the end, you're getting these weird alien backdrops and fighting like robots and stuff.
Isn't that how it worked in X-Men also?
Could be.
That's yeah. That was the original Alice in Wonderland manuscript. Lewis Carroll was intending it to be a robot.
I think Jabberwock was actually like an eldritch god from another
probably.
Dimension. Yeah.
But, yeah, so there's a lot of
originally
cool
called Arkanoid in Wonderland. Interestingly enough. Arkanoid in Wonderland.
But yeah, this game. You know, from what I've played of it, manages to avoid the pitfalls, literal pitfalls that sometimes plague isometric platformers. I feel like it's very good about giving you visual cues about where you need to be. There's really great use of shadow and mm-hmm. kind of positioning and relationships between objects. So it's not like Landstalker where the game is kind of a hit or miss crapshoot where you're like, I got to jump now. I hope I'm jumping at the right time. I can't tell because there are no shadows to guide me.
Is it a continuous scrolling game? You're forced to scroll,
no.
or do you go forward?
No, I think it follows
yeah,
you.
Yeah, you're
you
under
can,
your
you
own
can power.
Okay, that's better.
Yeah, but like I said, like the layout of the levels has got it's this very Marble Madness look. So it's really clear what you're jumping on because it's just this floating kind of abstract course.
Yeah, it's called March and Maze. So you are scrolling around a lot. So it's not a forced scrolling shooter for sure.
That's cool.
Yeah, if you
any home ports of this, anybody know on anything?
I didn't write that down.
I
want to say that it has been on something at some point.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
I know that's really helpful.
Yeah,
look this up
look
at home,
up.
Kids. If you can find it, play.
No, we'll look it up right now.
Oh well, all right.
It is on the PC Engine and X68000.
Well, that's
and it was released on Virtual Console, though maybe not for the US.
All right, well, I'll try it on the PC Engine.
Yeah, all the Japanese or all the dates here are Japanese only, so it's never been released in the US.
Anything we can create a Japanese account on and get it off their Virtual Console?
It's too late now. It's Wii Virtual Console.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, snap! You missed your target of opportunity.
Maybe someday.
I bet the PC Engine version is not very expensive because I never hear people talk about it, and you hear people talk about games that are expensive because. They need to lament it. eBay says, here's a PC Engine Who card for $33.
Cool. Yeah.
Not bad.
Hey, it just sold. Chris?
That's weird. It's gone.
No. Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Not too bad, but they should still put it on Switch because it looks like a lot of fun.
All right. Also from 1988, the exact opposite of March and May's Splatterhouse. Do we need to talk about this that much? We've had an entire episode on Splatterhouse. But if you guys have memories of Splatterhouse, please.
What a great name.
Isn't it?
What an amazing title for a game.
It was, you could get it on the TurboGrafx-16, and that was a good reason to get one of those instead of a Nintendo, because you couldn't play those kind of graphic games on the consoles.
Yeah, my friend who had a TurboGrafx when I was a kid, like, his whole thing was, I mean, it's got Splatterhouse.
Yeah.
Yeah, this the aesthetic of this game is not really my speed, but I get that some people really love it, that ooky, spooky, gory, it's there to look gross. Horror kind of thing.
Yeah. Like, there are literally guts dripping all over the stages. Like, that's its thing,
basically. Well, I feel like, I know, I've played Splatterhouse 3 on the Genesis. It's my favorite one in this series.
But that one's really different. It's kind of like an exploratory, like, find your way through the house sort of thing.
It has different elements to it.
This one is a very straightforward hack and slash.
This is like a beat 'em up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is like, this is pretty much Wonder Momo, but instead of playing, I'm serious. Like, in terms of mechanics, it's pretty similar to Wonder Momo, except that instead of being like a cute little teenage girl, you are
Rick.
A horrible dude with muscles and a Jason mask.
Probably no one Rick. Wants to see his panties.
Yeah, right. And it's obvious.
Let's not go there.
An obvious play on Jason from the Friday the 13th series. His name is Rick. He wields a 2x4 weapon in a basement.
Among other things.
Yeah, you can pick up weapons. Like a cleaver in this and like slice things in half with it.
I love that this game is very clearly based on the premise of, okay, but what if you were Jason? And also Jason was the good guy.
Yeah.
It's three leaps of logic away from...
Isn't that there a movie like that? Like Jason in Hell or something where he's sort of the protagonist?
I don't know. I don't like scary movies. Mm-hmm. I do like Jason X though. Jason X is extremely good.
Are you sure it's not Jason 10?
Pretty sure it's not Jason 10.
Just checking. This game also is kind of based on there's a little bit of Lovecraft to it. Like you go into a mansion and you start out in the basement and you just like descend into a grislier and grislier version of hell. For my money, the best Splatterhouse game is Wanpaku Graffiti for Famicom, which is the cute, fun little parody game. Like one of the bosses you fight is an alien from Aliens that like very cutely pops out of a dude's chest and starts popping around.
Does it sing "Hello, my baby, hello, my honey"?
It pretty much is like the Spaceballs gag. Yeah, for sure.
Splatterhouse is neat because it had the gall, I don't know what the temerity to go into being such a graphic. Like dial it up to 11 graphic game with gross monsters and goriness and things like
that. Yeah, I mean, I kind of feel like this was kind of the same through line that you had with, you know, these games that were set in Jikoku.
Oh my God.
But thanks. instead of being set in like Japanese hell, the hell of Japanese folklore and mythology, it's more like scary Hollywood movies and gross out. And, you know, the whole body horror thing in video games was kind of a big deal around this time. You had stuff like Life Force and Abadox and that sort of thing, where it was just like, how gross can we get? This game, Namco was like, we are going to get all the gross. We are going to get the most gross.
Yeah.
And I don't think they were quite as crass as, you know, Chiller, but it was up there. It was definitely pushing the limits. I feel like this was designed to anger Tipper Gore.
Yeah. I think it was designed some limits, but I think it's a neat game. It's a beat 'em up. It's got this theme. If you like this kind of theme, then it's your game. You know, if you like beat 'em ups and you like crazy horror movie grotesqueness, you know, which by modern standards, it doesn't even really look like that based on what we can render now. But, you know, it's still at the time it was.
Yeah. I mean, what do you guys feel about the Splatterhouse relaunch from like 10 years ago by Gas Powered Games?
Yeah. I don't remember if I played it. I remember it existing.
Didn't play it. It looked like it took itself too seriously.
Yeah, yeah.
Because for me, Splatterhouse is not necessarily in the vein of like a Friday the 13th or a Nightmare on Elm Street. It's more like Evil Dead or Army of Darkness, where, you know, a guy gets punched and 18 gallons of blood shoot out like that. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's because of the way it by necessity looks on a video game where things are kind of
exaggerated.
You know, exaggerated and a little bit silly, like because you're walking through this house and it's sewers forever.
Yeah, I mean, it's still stylized. Endless like it's got sewers. all these guts and gore, but it's not like ultra realistic.
Yeah. And I think like all the Because the monster designs are genuinely creepy and weird and gross, but I feel like that gross out aspect of it, again, like lends itself to something that's more horror comedy than what you get here.
That's funny because at the time
I'm Pickle Rick fighting through the mansion.
I think that that's more of a like a retrospective point of view, because at the time I didn't feel like it was a cute take on gross things. You know,
probably not.
It, sorry, looks it was just like going it, for as gross as it could
on
do with that.
What we see today, you know, like it's not as realistic as it maybe could be, but it's the guy's a little chunky, proportion weird kind of. Stumpy looking guy.
But I also remember the comic book ads for Splatterhouse that were very like, again, because they were running in Marvel Comics in 1988, like were also very kind of cartoonally drawn, cartoonishly drawn.
Cartoonally.
Yeah.
We'll look at one last game before we wrap this up so Binge can eat and also I can eat. And that is Assault and Assault Plus, which for some reason I thought I had played before, but then I sat down to do the research for this episode and realized I've never played this before. Like, this is a Super NES Mode 7 game 3 years before the 2 years before the Super NES launched in Japan. It's ahead of its time is what I'm saying. Kind of like Thunder Scepter. This is like the kind of game you would be seeing on Super NES a few years later, and Namco got there first, planted a flag in it, and then abandoned the kingdom. Chris, you have something to say.
This is awful and I hate it.
You have motion sickness.
I have motion sickness.
Oh, yeah.
Why would you do this? This is the work. Because what it is you are in a tank driving around.
It is it's a solipsism simulator.
Everything else around you rotates while your tank remains static. I hate it. It's so bad.
So it's like, so another thing on Super Nintendo, Contra 3 did this for bonus stages.
And kinda, Brandish did this kind of, not with the smooth scrolling because it started out on a PC, which that's a whole other story. But the idea of like you are always true north and everything spins around you is definitely a thing you would see in other games.
It's kind of weird and disorienting.
Yeah.
And it does. And so it scales. So it's got, like I said, it looks exactly like Mode 7 in that the main gimmick is there's this big background that's being rotated and scaled, because you can also like hit these jump pads that send your tank flying up in the air, and you can like mortar the enemies farther away from you, which seems like a useful thing to be able to do. But it does it with this same scheme of just scaling the background constantly.
This, I can see why this would give you motion sickness.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I bet it's not so bad if you're playing it. Yeah. But if you're just watching, you're
a little better.
Like,
but
it looks cool, though. I have never played this, and it's a crime, because this is really incredible looking.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're comparing it to Mode 7.
Yeah.
And like I said, there's this whole eschatological discussion to be had there, but I'm really impressed because, you know, the hardware here is also good at rotating the sprites that appear on the map. You don't really like when you have the rotating stages on Super NES, I feel like they were a lot clumsier about the way sprites rotated along with the background.
Because it was only hooked up to the background.
Right,
layer.
The Mode 7 was just really, for one layer of the background.
Yeah, if you wanted to really rotate something else, you had to make it into a fake background and do some trickery. Yeah.
Or else do some sort of rotation with the sprites through like drawing them at different angles, or else use a Super FX chip or Super FX 2 chip like Yoshi's Island did.
I'd like to point out that if you're trying to visualize what this game looks like, when they're saying Mode 7, it's not like Mario Kart where you're looking out a plane, like a tilted plane that's scaling and rotating. It's a straight top-down view of a flat stage that rotates around you as you move.
Yeah, I mean, it's like we said, it's Contra 3. The bonus stages from Contra 3,
only more so.
Yeah,
way more so. Konami should be ashamed. They were one upped 3 years before.
Is there a home port of this anywhere?
I do not think so. Assault did show up on one of the Namco museums. So there's a version on PlayStation.
Yeah, I was gonna say probably it wouldn't have been possible on a home console for a while after it came out.
Yeah, so these fell into a gap. The NES gap, I guess. Some of them came out before the NES, and so they couldn't have like good home ports, even if they were possible. And then some were like so advanced that they came out before the Super NES and the Genesis and stuff, so they weren't really possible either. So,
yeah, I mean, 1986 through 88 saw, at least in Japan, the debut of the PC Engine, the TurboGrafx 16, and the Sega Mega Drive or Sega Genesis. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we were, even on the home front, we were moving into the 16-bit consoles at this point, or 16-bit in the case of TurboGrafx.
Mm-hmm. I did air quotes.
I did air quotes. Yeah. Everyone could see it at home.
Yeah.
It was in my voice.
Where's the camera in here?
That's a secret. So definitely, like, you know, arcade hardware is always a step ahead of home hardware anyway, or was back in the day. Mm-hmm. So, so the stuff was pretty hard to reproduce at home, and they were really experimenting with what they could get away with arcade boards. And I don't think it was quite as impressive as what Sega was doing, but it was still pretty damn impressive.
I agree.
Well, excellent. Okay, so I think we will wrap there. I think there's room in us, there's energy in us for one more Namco episode. I don't want to, you know, drag it out, but you know, there's still some cool stuff that they produced in the years to come. So we should definitely touch on the highlights in a later episode. I'm having trouble forming sentences now and actually pronouncing words. So to me, that is a sign that we need to break and have some food. My body is requiring calories.
It is definitely lunchtime.
So that doesn't do any good for you, the listeners, but I promise that when we come back and record another episode, I will actually be using real human words again. It's very exciting. So, guys, video games, huh? How about that?
Yeah.
There were some good ones.
Crazy.
Some of these I want to play.
Chris, you seem muted about video games.
Sum it all up.
I'm also ready for lunch.
Okay. In conclusion, Namco is a land of many contrasts. So, yes, everyone, thanks for listening to this latest iteration of our Namco series, Namco Volume 3. Maybe we should do 5 and each one should get a little letter on it. Maybe spell out Namco. I think that's a great original idea.
Put them on CD.
They could borrow that idea from us, honestly. Yeah. Yes, so I am Jeremy Parrish, and you have been listening to Retronauts, in case you were wondering. Thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. You can listen to us every single freaking week on whatever podcasting service we end up joining. We're not sure yet at this point, but we'll be on iTunes and other places, so listen to us there. Or you can support us on Patreon, get your episodes a week early with higher bitrate quality and no advertisements. That's $3 a month at patreon.com/retronauts. I'm not going to hard sell you. If you like this show, it was kind of an all over the place sort of show, but if you love rambling discourse about old video games, by God, do we have a podcast for you? Come support us. Anyway, you guys, what's up? Let's go backwards this time.
I'm Chris Sims. You can find all my stuff by going to the-isb.com. That has links to all the other podcasts that I do and comic books that I write and other things that I write online. And I'm a freelancer. So if you want me to write something, if you've got that Rolling Thunder license, holla at your boy. Look me up.
I'm Ben Elgin. You can find me on Twitter as Kirin. That's K-I-R-I-N-N. Most of my other retro projects are kind of on hold right now, but you know, maybe after I actually get some lunch, some of them will come back. We'll see.
Yeah. And I'm Ben Jedwards. Right now I am making my living building bespoke artisanal handcrafted small batch organic joysticks for retro game consoles, including Virtual Boy, Sega Saturn, everything. Super Nintendo, Genesis, Atari, everything. Anyway, bxfoundry.com, bxfoundry.com is the domain, and you can find me on Twitter at Ben Jedwards.
I can vouch for his sticks. They're very good. You owe me a couple still, though. So anyway, thanks everyone for joining us. Thanks you guys for joining me. Thanks Namco for making video games for us to talk about, and some of which we openly dismissed out of hand. Take that. Anyway, we'll be back again in a few days with a Friday episode, probably. If not, that'll be next week. But definitely, we'll be back next Monday. Look forward to it. Oh my God, it's going to be great.